Thank you very much, Lainey. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah,
fine. So I hadn't really thought about it as a Western title, but then it did occur to me once I'd set it in the title. There's a well-respected Western. I don't know if you're into Westerns, but I will seek to cover the good, the bad, and the ugly as we progress. Thinking about life as a trial statistician, this is what I want to talk about. I'm going to give you a little bit of background about me, because that'll maybe help explain something I'm going to talk about or moan about and complain about, and also where I'm coming from, because other trial statisticians could have a different, slightly different set, but I think there's enough in common that'll be interesting to everyone, hopefully, here. And I don't want to finish on ugly. I thought that was a bad end note, so I'm going to put a little bit more good at the end. So my personal odyssey, if I can put it that way, I started, Jill might vaguely remember this, as an undergraduate in Aberdeen. I did a student project related to clinical trials, in fact randomised controlled trials, which was back in 1999. And from that there was an opportunity to do a PhD, which was on the related topic with colleague of Jill's at the time, and then later a colleague of mine, because I stayed on. So my interest has gone through all my professional career. It's gone from very early on in my studies into clinical trials, and mainly randomised controlled trials, working up in Aberdeen at the Health Services Research Unit. And then for a year I spent in Canada, so I got to see a bit of a different environment. And then about 5 years ago I moved down here to Oxford to work at the Centre for Statistics and Medicine, and happily enough, people that I was already working with from Aberdeen were in a department, and there was an opportunity to move into that department, which CSM then moved into that department. So quite a complicated story. Basically two sets of people I worked with kind of moved together, so it made quite a nice setup for me and way to transition in quite a gentle way after my big break from Aberdeen after 15 years or so. So I have been involved in over trials for over 18 years, which I know what you're thinking, I'm not old enough, surely. Far too young for that. And I've been involved in about 20 trials of various types, I think. From very small, one-man band sort of trials, if we could put it that way in the old traditional sense, as it was usually one man who kind of did everything by himself, a clinician, but then turned up with a bunch of data, pretty much. It was slightly better than that by the time I started, but it was only slightly better than that, I think. But also then moving into the much more diverse and better and high quality and large, expensive trials, sometimes too expensive maybe, trials that we can get nowadays, and from a variety of different funders and different types of treatments. So I mainly have worked looking at non-drug treatments, and specifically those that involve surgery, but I have dabbled a bit in what people might be familiar with, you know, the regulatory language of CTIMPs and physiotherapy and other types of things, which you didn't even know was something you could put in a trial until someone came to you. And through that time I've had an interest in methodology. I was lucky to work in a group that had an interest not just in doing trials but how you do trials, and then I had my PhD topic, and these things kind of are there with you throughout your career often, and come back to haunt you sometimes, and also in a positive sense you get hopefully some sort of reputation for it. I also worked in some other generic sort of trial issues, but very much on the applied side, so you will not, I can assure you, see any formula in this presentation. Might be a relief at this time on a Monday. So there you go. And then I've been involved in lots of DMCs. Have you been introduced to that terminology? Or some of you would be familiar, or DSMCs, or so data monitoring committees, and TSCs, or trial steering committees, or the equivalent of management type committees, etc. I've been involved in loads of them. Funding panels, even for trials, more recent. So it's a fairly broad experience of trials, but very much on the academic side, and involved in the various different roles on both sides of the fence. And then, well, recently I've been line managing some trial statisticians, so I don't do the hard work really anymore. Other people I work with do the hard work, and I vaguely try and help them occasionally. Okay. I'm happy to take any comments or queries, by the way, if things go along, but hopefully most things will be pretty straightforward. So good, what a better place to start. So what's so good about clinical trials? Well, you probably had a bit of this already, but as a statistician, there's probably a few ways you can think about this. If I was to give you one phrase about that, I'd say it gives you a safe and great environment to do statistics. And one thing that you should never take for granted is that it is a design study. By definition, a clinical trial is some sort of experiment or study looking at the impact of the treatment. Therefore, that implies someone thought about it before it happened. And let me reassure you, unless you're in any doubt, people do come to you with data who haven't thought about what they're doing and just happen to think you might be able to explain it to them, why they're bothering collecting data and why they even bothered doing it in the first place. Whereas in trials, you're nice and safe in the sense that it's designed, and therefore also the data you're going to get is prospective, and that just saves so much horrible mess from you. Generally speaking, they're funded studies as well, to varying degrees, but that also ensures a certain degree of forethought and rigour and sort of due process and oversight. Studies are regulated. I'll come back to the con of regulation to a degree, but it is a very positive thing because it ensures data quality in a way that isn't true in many other areas. You do get very high quality studies that are not clinical trials, but you get very many studies that are not high quality that are not clinical trials. And so this process of regulation and understanding that what we're doing is a serious business leads to data, I would say, generally speaking, of a better quality and a rigorous process. And then lastly, I'd say it's worthwhile. We are doing something that's useful and adds to our understanding. Understanding in the very altruistic, generic sense. We're trying to gain insight so that we can help improve patients' health and we can make judgments about what treatment people should or shouldn't get and who should be treated and why they should be treated. So we're addressing something important. There are analyses that are not very important and they are out there. And then it's varied. There are phases that people use to talk about clinical trials, phase 1 to phase 4, which works well for CTIMs or drug treatments, but really they're a very varied feast actually, even of the same type. This is a slide that I sometimes use teaching about phase of clinical trials, which probably no one will agree with exactly with all the things I've put on here, but what we do have is a real, you can see just very easily, the aim of what you're trying to do in clinical trials vary quite a lot, from very exploratory to efficacy, so-called, the impact of the treatment, post-marketing surveillance is language that might be used in an industry setting, but the size is varying hugely, from very small studies to very large studies. The population can vary, the design is varying, and whether we even have basic things like a control group and the outcome and how we're going to assess the result of the study. And I have mostly focused on what might be called phase 3 ones here. And even those are a very, very mixed batch. And that's part of the exciting thing about being involved. And so I just want to emphasise a little bit about RCTs, because we need to remind ourselves that they are a really good thing to do, because this is what most of us as trial statisticians will spend most of our time doing. And you can view this in many different ways. You probably had some of this today, so I will just flick through very quickly. But you can describe it in very simple language. You address a scenario of interest, treatment or not treatment, or treatment A versus treatment B. You produce groups that are expected to be similar. It allows you to isolate the factor of interest, that is the treatment usually. It prevents intentional and unintentional bias. It provides clarity on inclusion and inception point of participation, not something to take for granted. You do get into discussions about who is in my study and who should be in my study. And all those things you do. If you want to think of it more as a statistician, there are actually a different way that we can think about that or describe it. In fact, it's one of the, I think, the exciting and good things about being a trial statistician. Trials are very complicated. They're also very simple. So the concept, very simply, is tossing a coin, or Ian Chalmers used to use, and talking about children when they separate out into two teams, tic-tac-toe, if you know that. It's a very simple concept. You're trying to roughly randomly create two teams, two groups that are going to be similar. In that sense, you're trying to create a fair game. Here, you're trying to say the only difference is the treatment, therefore, I know the treatment works. That is true, but it's also true that we can think about it in a more mathematical or complex sense. And the one word, a word you'll often see is exchangeability. It just means basically that everything is the same except for the treatment, and you can write out formulas and justify it on that basis. There is a whole framework of statistics, classical statistics, which you will have been introduced, I would think, either in this course or related ones to some degree. But a really cool thing about randomization is it justifies an analysis with no further assumptions needed. It's not necessarily what we do day to day as a statistician, but actually there is a theoretical basis for doing an analysis, for creating things like a p-value, that doesn't rely on anything else. And then there's also a very different way that is growing actually more recently in the literature, which is a causal way to think about it. And you can express things in terms of the observed or the counterfactual thing. If you think about trials, they are a little bit counterfactual in the sense that you create two groups. We can never really assess what we want to know, which is if you have a patient in front of you and you're a doctor, you want to really know what would be the result they would have with the two treatments. So you give treatment A, but you can't go back in time and then say, okay, let's give them treatment B. That's the counterfactual. But you can express trials in that way, and you can actually take that into another direction in terms of mathematics and thinking. So that's another way you can do it. And then lastly, you have Bayesian statistics, which probably is not touched on too much in this course, but that's another way that you can think of randomized controlled trials and the value you might think of trials in terms of refining your understanding or updating your prior by getting good data. Okay. So if we take that for granted, what are the other values or what are the good things about being a trial statistician? And I'll probably the best place to start is high impact studies. There's my high impact. You will see the language gold standard, you'll hear it to death. RCTs are the gold standard, the way to compare treatments or something like that. This is another quote. Clinical trials are the most definitive tool for evaluation of the applicability of clinical research. It's very fancy language, it's very nice. Ultimately, in many regards, when it comes to treatment about comes to research about treatments, RCTs, or clinical trials more generally, are the standard which other research has held to account. And they are the most researched area, and roughly speaking, the methods and the process are most well thought out. So the outworking of that is that they're generally the most well respected, and they have the highest potential impact. And that impact can be in two ways. It can be direct impact. If you work as a trial statistician or you work on a trial, your trial might directly change things straight away as soon as it's published. And that's very exciting. That, sadly, is not true of most trials, so I'd be lying if I stood up here and told you that every trial is going to do that. Everything's going to change straight away. Nevertheless, it's also true that some of them do have that dramatic impact, and there's a potential there for your study to do that. It is also true that the impact of your study might be more subtle or indirect, but it'll come over time. You are contributing a trial, a result, which might be then taken with a body of evidence, and it might eventually end up in a systematic review, you would hope, or maybe a meta-analysis. And through that, you're contributing again to practice and the updating of practice and the understanding. And that's irrespective of what the result is in many regards. This is an example of a paper that was by a colleague of mine up in the department, and he was involved in a study called Draft. I don't expect you to be able to read that at the bottom, but the title you probably can read, which says, "Do Large Chromatic Randomized Trials Change Clinical Practice?" What is interesting, this is a graph that they show. What they show here is the use of different treatments for the condition of interest. This is orthopedics, this is trauma. And they've got wires, which is a blue line, plate, which is a red line, and then they've got other. So the other is not what they were evaluating in the trial, and that stayed pretty constant over this period of about 10 years, which is shown on the x-axis. But what happens is there's quite a dramatic change, or particularly an uptake in the wire, which was one of the two interventions in this trial, plate being the other. And because this was a very large trial and then influenced involving the large teaching hospitals, by purely doing the trial seemed to actually influence the practice, and people became more aware of the alternative, were taught, which is not always true in surgery, about the options that are available, and actually started using it. And then when the results of the trial actually came out, that seemed to be hastened even more. So the trial, very quickly, even before it was actually completed, seems to have influenced practice. And then when the results came out to reassure the use of wire, it's had continued in this quite dramatic increase. This is another one, again, you'll forgive me for using orthopedic examples, because it's where I work, most familiar with of recent. There's another study, which again, this trial is called PROFER. All I want to highlight here is the conclusion, which you may or may not be able to read, but it says PROFER has had an impact on surgeons' clinical practice, both through changing it and through underpinning existing non-operative practice. So trials, aside from their direct result, they also can be an embodiment of good practice in many clinical areas. Surgery is certainly one. And here they're highlighting that although not everyone accepted immediately the result of the trial, everyone knew about it pretty much, or a lot did, and many recognised that their practice was being influenced by it. So it's just another example of how trials can have a big impact. This, for me personally, is my most recent example, and if you get a paper in The Lancet, you like to tell people that I've got a paper in The Lancet, hence why I have this slide, and this is, came out just last month, but this got some uptake and some newspapers and whatever, so will be interesting to see, but the word is that it's actually starting to influence people's practice as well. And here, this is about shoulder impingement, which was a growing and reasonably common shoulder operation, and we did what you might call a placebo form of the shoulder operation. You can ask me afterwards about that if you're interested, but anyway, it didn't show that there was much benefit for the real surgery, so it's quite controversial. And if you're into ultrametrics, it's got something like 1,300 as its ultrametric score, which is pretty big, given that most of my papers have about 10 or something like that. Okay, moving on. I think something that's hidden, because a lot of statisticians who work in other areas look down on trials, is the variety of work and the issues that it raised. And I think they can involve almost any type of analysis, at least to some degree. You can argue and you can defend for very simple things like Fisher's exact test, if you know the names, or t-test, and quite robustly and confidently use such simple tests when you do at least some clinical trials and randomised trials. Having said that, though, there's such a wide variety of issues and concepts that are addressed in the statistical literature that come into clinical trials. So issues such as clustering, if people are familiar with that, the idea that some observations are more similar as a group to each other than they are to every other observation. And so you get a variety of statistical methods like multi-level modelling and GEs. These are sort of things that people familiar for other areas are options. You have the longitudinal aspect of trials in most cases. You have different types of outcomes, quite different types of outcomes, which bring up different types of analysis. Just about any regression you can think of, you can find a way to analyse in a trial somewhere. And then you also have, more recently, a lot of the causal work, which I alluded to earlier. There's a whole ream of growing literature on that, which, interesting enough, a lot of it has come from economics and the interest in doing looking at the impact of policy in health economics and trying to isolate factors, but actually it's found a use in analysing clinical trials, and increasingly so. So don't be misled by thinking it's all just one very simple thing. And you do the same type of analysis, although there's actually a vast array of different things. And the core analysis, as I say, can be straightforward, but there's many interesting layers. My next good topic is, I think it's generally accepted that you're a valued part of a team delivering a study. You're valued for your expertise, even if sometimes a bit grudgingly. People need you. You'll often see people present and say, speak to a statistician, repeat their final slide, or they'll say something like that, at least to get sample size. They might think vaguely you should do something more than that, but more often than not, increasingly, is my experience, maybe I've been fortunate, is that people do recognise your expertise, they do recognise the value, and they do recognise more generally that as a trial statistician, you understand things about the study, about how to do it, what's the right way to do it, how could you improve a study, what's the right way to go about it. In fact, sometimes from is more getting rid of them than actually coming, than actually the problem of them listening to you per se. I think also this has been my experience, that you get to work with some excellent scientists. The whole process can be quite time-consuming to do a clinical trial. It's a long-run process, but one positive is the people who tend to get there at the end often are very, not always, I'll have to confess, but often very good, thorough, experienced researchers and people who have good scientific understanding. So they're quite enjoyable people to be around and just spend and be part of the team with. You will work with lots of professional people, particularly when you're in the large studies. There will be professional managers for the project. There will be professional data managers as well who have their role. There will be programmers who specialise often in doing trial databases. And that expertise is a very exciting thing to be part of. And they're often not always nice people, I think. And then what is fun is that you're there to deliver, I would say, a unique trial. There is a sense that trials is a robust methodology, and that's true, but the application of it every time, I would say, is unique in some ways, that trials have their own life to themselves, and events that happen, whether it's personnel related or otherwise, that makes it quite an interesting thing to be part of, and unpredictable what's going to happen to. So you're working and pulling together to get there to the finishing line, and so that's really enjoyable. One of the special things, I think, about being a trial statistician is that, as well as being part of the team, you have a very unique perspective, and you're one of the few, maybe the only person sometimes, who, other than maybe the CI who's involved from the very beginning to the very end, at least that possibility is there for you, from the very kernel of an idea or working through to a PICO type idea, all the way to thinking about funding and a grant application and getting that, and then setting up the study and then running it and all the rest, and then to the analysis and the reporting. And also when it's running as a statistician, you get through the data, you get to understand how things all connect up. And I find that not everyone who's involved in a trial really has that perspective. So it's really quite a privilege, I think, in some ways to do that. And it allows you to input into all things. You have something useful to say about data collection and how forms are completed. You have something useful to say about databases and how they're set up and how the data comes out and how it's processed and about data quality and all these other things. This here is a picture of a team that I particularly enjoy being part of, and it's not because it's been some dramatic, glamorous thing. This has not ended up in The Lancet by any means, but what was very fun was it was people who wanted to do a trial. They were new to it, but there was a keen interest, and so I put it up. Also, it was quite a fun picture, I think. This was tweeted by the journal, you wouldn't believe it. But I personally have enjoyed working with that group, and it was a new area, and they were just very interested and keen to do it. And what's nice to say also is that we did a pilot study, and now we've got funding to go and do the proper study, so we're continuing to work together. Another nice thing about, or maybe special thing about being a trial statistician, is that you get to know the answer for other people. First to know, data monitoring committee, I'll come back to them on the negative side, but on the positive side, you get to know the answer. Everybody wants to know the answer, and they know it. It's great. And then the final answer as well, that's the most special thing, because the results in between can change, and you don't get always to see the full picture, but you will be the first person who sits down with the results, and you will know before anyone else really which way this thing is going to go. So with Seesaw, we knew, we and the other strategists, we knew that this was going to be quite controversial. That's quite exciting. I quite like this quote. It said, "I learned that some things are best kept secret." It is a slightly funny position as a statistician that you have this information, but you've got to not reveal it. But it is quite an exciting thing as well. Okay, bad. Scale of work. I did say Seesaw, but I'm going to say the negative, only because it's very familiar with me in the scale of work. So SAPs are not bad, but it's quite a lot of work to produce a good SAP. 31 pages is what we had for Seesaw. Others will produce much longer documents. There's a lot of work involved. Lots of analysis. You tend to think of primary outcomes or maybe a few other outcomes. We had 9 analysis, that's of only the primary in the main paper. We also have supplementary paper, 18 analysis of primary outcome, 28 of secondary outcomes. So that's 46 analysis. Now, one of the things about publishing it, which is very frustrating, is you keep producing the same thing in different formats, and every time it gets revised, you have to double check, and every time someone's touched it, it's changed. And so I counted up recently, there's 618 numbers in the proof that we needed to check. Now, you would think that if you checked it once in the proof, you might think that you can just rely on those numbers being right. You'd be wrong, though. It doesn't matter how good a journal it is, you will find, in fact, we found 2 numbers which we hadn't asked for any changes in. There were other ones where we had asked for changes and they hadn't changed it the way we asked them to. So we found 2 numbers that were correct in the original proof that were then wrong in the later proof. So you have to do that checking every time. That's in addition to all the checks that you did on the multiple versions around multiple collaborators. So it just gives you a feel for the scale of work at the end, which then you, if you think through back the way to about how much that would be analysis, it's a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of energy. Whereas some people seem to get away with one outcome as their kind of the whole study. That sadly is not true of clinical trials. It's a long process. My first involvement in this study was November 2010. To get involved in the grant application, published in November, so that's 7 years. From initial analysis, which was 2016, to publication, 16 months. So actually, when I knew the results, we knew the results as a team, it took 16 more months to get it published. That sounds crazy, doesn't it? And the other thing about that was it was only 2 journals. One journal took basically about a year. Finally decide with the back and forth with about 40 page resubmission and response to reviewer comments before they decided they were going to reject it. So even when you think you're done, you're not actually done. Which brings me on my next point, which is increasing demand SOPs. I put down as necessary evil. I guess they are. They're SOPs. Who knows how many SOPs there are? Nobody, I don't even know how many sops I put here. Nobody ever knows how many sops there are. It's always changing, and the sops are always changing. I am not most fond of sops, but they do and are necessary, and increasingly necessary in part of what clinical trials are about, particularly if you work on drug trials. And it is something as a trial statistician you have to accept, I'm afraid, that is part of your life, and sometimes too much part of your life. But there you go. And they very much symbolise, it's not really fair to say it's about SOPs, they very much symbolise increasing scrutiny and expectations that have come about, for good reasons, mostly, about trials and about safe conduct and about people's data and about handling things appropriately and robustness. And if you have good SOPs and you follow SOPs, they will be very useful when you need to defend yourself and defend your study and what you've got up to. Oh, there's another shock. Expectations on data. Alongside that, there has been a much greater emphasis. Good, but when the scale, when you put it together, scale, it's very demanding about CRFs and the process, and as a statistician, to sign off and check and make sure. And it's true of what I said before, that you are the person who can look at all these things, but it falls on you, and you're the person who has to make sure it's done right. And you have 1,000 data items in the database to double check, and you have to check that they've all got the right coding as well. It's down on you. So, and that's, I would say, increased in the time I've been involved. And then also more so about how it's getting stored. And this is an area that's still developing and will be increasing for the next 5-10 years, about where data ends up and about the process in which you make it available to others. So even when you've finished, you haven't finished. You've still got other responsibilities that will go on as a trial statistician beyond what you think of as your involvement as a trial. And then on top of that, there's more documents. Again, for good reasons, all have the right place, but it's just more things that you're involved in, more things you have to make are consistent and standard. And so it does create work, good as they are. Another bad side, this is what someone told me recently, I wasn't independent enough. That's a trial statistician there. You see, this is all the offers. That's you stuck in the middle there. That is a statistician's bugbear in general, but it's very much true as a trial statistician. You don't usually get to be the lead, the first offer, or the grant lead. You don't usually get to do the presentations that give you all the glory. You will be stuck somewhere in the middle. The good thing is you get involved in multiple studies, but the bad thing is people will sometimes think, well, what did he do? Did he actually do anything? I assure you I did. But they're not convinced because you're fourth offer or whatever and there's 30 offers. So to some, quite, depend on their perspective, people quite high up in universities, they're not convinced you're doing very much. Or at least you're not independent. It can make promotion more difficult. I'm talking on an academic sense, but perhaps the same might be true in industry to a degree. You may not always perceive you as a leader, and so it does create a problem, I think, which is fair to say. I think you can get there in the end, but it tends to be a little bit more difficult or slower, I think. Reinventing the wheel, this is my other bugbear of trials. I feel every trial I'm doing something that someone's done before and done it better, but somehow I'm still doing it and working on what I'm going to do. And it's been solved. But we can always reassure ourselves, because the good thing about reinventing the wheel is you get around one. So you will get there in the end, but it does seem like a gross waste of time. That is a bugbear. DMCs. Very good to do DMCs, don't get me wrong, but they are a lot of work. And you get quick turnaround, so you're expected to do things maybe in a couple of weeks and churn out a report of 30 pages and not make any errors, and then people pour over them. It's never as automated as you feel it should. The last thing is particularly true of DMCs. You feel like you've done it once, why doesn't it take that, but it never is like that. The closer you can get that, the better. This is a sort of Damocles. There was a study up in Aberdeen called the Damocles Group, which did a great piece of work, which was giving guidance on DMZs and how to set them up, and also produced very handy terms of reference that you could use for DMZs. Their idea was the Sword of Damocles as sort of deciding whether the study continues or not. I'm suggesting the Sword of Damocles in a different sense, in that that's all your spare time to do interesting things, just about to get chopped off your life. And perhaps most greatly, you get no direct academic credit for it. If you're there at the end, then you will get credit somewhat, but no one will give you any credit, really. But no one will really thank you either. Hardly anyone sees the results of your labour. Like three or four people often. You may have heard the definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. But that is what you do in the DMC. It's quite ironic, I think. If I move on to further analysis and sub-studies, I'm taking it no one's particularly interested in screws. Because there are different types of screws, and it's very important you have different types of screws. But there is a reason why sub-studies are sub-studies, and further analysis are further analysis. And the same with butterflies. Most of us are not that interested in the types of butterflies. And so I want to give you a quick list of five things I would say I've learned to watch out for. One is the observational comparison within the randomised control trial. The amount of investigators who come to me later, after they've seen the main result, and basically talk their way around to saying, could you not just do the observational comparison? It's incredible. There's also there is a positive study in there waiting for discovery. Delete as applicable, false positive or false negative discovery. That's the case of, well, we'll just keep analysing it in various ways and eventually we'll get the result we want. There's also the I have data, please make me a paper on X people who turn up. The study was done, there's data associated with it. They hadn't really thought about what they were just getting, quote unquote, imaging data or something like that. And then you're supposed to turn this into a study in your spare time because no one ever gives you time to do it. The completely unrelated sub-studies, I think, is a very dangerous one. And then the ill-judged PhD master, this is a fairly new one to me, but recently I came across a study as a DMC member where the CHI thought it was a good idea that two PhDs were closely tied to the progress of a trial, because we all know trials never ever need extensions to the recruitment periods and are always, always on time. And therefore we were in this awkward position of PhD students begging to get access to the data early, while the study is still ongoing, because they said, well, I need it to submit for my PhD. Great idea. Which leads me on to data requests. And this person up here, that's how it feels like as a trial starts or something. You just stick things through various cogs and eventually it comes out. Very thankless task, and also you spend a lot of time clearing up after other people. And the trial, it can never end sometimes. You get these related studies, not the ones you have to deliver, thankfully, but other people have a bright idea later that they want the data for something else. You get long-term follow-up. The study comes back to life, and then there's more work involved. Meta-analysis, I got a request last year for a study 5 years after the study was published, for a re-evaluation of one of the outcomes. So that takes quite a bit of time to remember what outcome they were talking about, even what study they were talking about, find the outcome, get access to the data. I'd moved cities by that point. And then to re-code it and then produce the data for them, in which case you send it to them and they don't reply. Which made it feel really worthwhile. But I think they did include it in their meta-analysis and their systematic review. And then you might get the last one, the next trial. If you do a good job or a half-decent job, people will come to you with their next trial. There's always a next trial. Every good CI has a next trial. And you might get wrapped into doing things to help with that, whether it's sample size. That can be a good opportunity, or it can be quite a burdensome extra thing that's now on your desk. And so you can get pulled in lots of different directions. I put all these in red because everyone wants it. It's all overdue. And this all happened to me in the last couple of months. And they've got all different the different things going on, and you can feel a bit overwhelmed, because no matter how well you plan different trials, you will be working on different trials, and they will all have their own timescales and agendas that you can control. So there are moments where you feel a bit like this guy up here. The ugly, as I move towards the end, probably the most uncomfortable thing is the bearer of the bad news. The classic one is the sample size need is much bigger than you expect. Akin to 60 isn't really that many, or variations on that theme. The trial result is negative. The despondency you can create in people as they see the result can be quite upsetting. And then, because this could be people's planned out their next 5 years' work, and the premise of this intervention that they've been spending the last 5 years working on, and then you're showing that it doesn't seem to actually work. And you also spend a lot of time saying no. No, we can't just change the analysis because you don't like the result. I've heard that one. I heard a surgeon recently said he didn't want to be part in a study because he didn't realise the result could show that something didn't work. I don't know where to start with that one. What seems to make sense to you is statistically a bad idea. You do spend quite a while, unfortunately, explaining what seems quite intuitive actually isn't a good idea. You can't analyse the data partway through because you were bored, keen to go to conference, want Christmas to come early. Variations on that theme, but you do get people who will repeatedly come to you, could we not just send an abstract in? Can we not just do this? I know it's taken a long time, so could we not? And then probably the worst thing is the Houston, we have a problem. Because of your role, like in data monitoring committees or other times, you see data or you observe the randomization. You're the person who spots that the programmers made an error in the randomization code. And therefore, the randomization has not been working properly. Or you're the person who spots when someone asks you to analyze something that actually the data doesn't exist, because nobody actually remembered to put it in the CRF. Or you're the person who worked out that one point we were asking about Saturdays and the other time we were asking about Fridays. Why would we choose to talk about Saturdays and Fridays when it's the same study? Surely we just wanted to pick one day. So you, unfortunately, are the person who finds these things often and then has to go to people and explain to them. And it's almost like you've created this problem, where really you're just the person who finds it. But then you're also left trying to resolve it as best can be done, which you often can't. And then I think my last one is ignorance. These are bandits, by the way. This is Lego, in case you're confused. This comes in various forms. This is my gripe at the moment. Some reviewers, you spent all this time, done all this work, and then you'll get little statements where people just basically scrap your whole study and make it a whole load of rubbish in like a couple of sentences, which don't even make that much sense, in my opinion. Or I was recently, as part of a group, we were accused of confirmation bias. Who knows what confirmation bias is? Anyone? One or two people. Well, I was guilty of it, apparently, which was news to me. Or we were as a group, because the person wrote a nice, eloquent statement about how they'd been so clever to spot in about two sentences in the whole paper that we'd been guilty of confirmation bias. And so again, they just discarded the whole study on the basis of two sentences, which could just be rewritten if they really had an objection to the two sentences. So it can be very frustrating, I think, as a statistician, about the scale and effort and process that's done to produce something that's rigorous and has produced data that people can shape and get reformatted if they really don't like what you've done. And yet people will still just discard it very simply. And then I was also in a group that was accused of academic dissembling. Dissembling is also not a word I was familiar with, but let me suggest it's not a nice thing to be accused of. And that again related to how we were dealing with adverse events. So it was only a small component of a report, but nevertheless we were accused of academic dissembling. Someone threatened to report us to the funder and the university. You do get collaborators in randomised control because people want to be involved who have a remarkable level of ignorance. I have heard surgeons, again, I'm always using surgeons, there must be other people who are like this, but I didn't realise that being in a randomised control trial meant I didn't get to choose the treatment. I've heard that one. I also heard people talk about other people who are way ahead of everyone else, including the blah blah people. I'm just making this not clear who it is on the statistical clinical. This person who is way ahead of everyone else had never done a trial in their life. But they were a mathematician, so therefore they must know everything. And then on the other side, as a reviewer, you can make investigators very unhappy. And I've had one who's very eminent phone me up and basically try and pressurise me in writing a letter that would retract my review because he didn't like it. So the good thing of trials is that they're very important, have high impact. The bad thing is, because a lot is at stake, sometimes, I'm not saying this is a normal, you can have a lot of pressure put on you as a statistician, and it comes out in the ignorance of the people who are doing it. People who should know better often do quite bad things. So to finish, some more good. I like trials. I'm glad I work in trials. It was opportunistic that I got involved in trials. I would encourage you to work in trials in whatever way works for you. And I would say there are galore of opportunities. There is opportunities to get publications. In fact, quick wins. I was very lucky. My first trial I got involved in ended up getting published in the BMJ. And also, which was very nice for me, I didn't have to be there all the way through it. I just turned up and somehow they didn't have a statistician at the very end, needed one, and I got to be involved at the very end. So within about 6 months, I had a BMJ paper. That's quite good. You do get things like that with trials. It does happen. But also, you do get to be involved in protocol publications and main trial results. There are sub-studies, good sub-studies. They're not all bad. And so it's a good way to build up your CV and just get involved in research. There are opportunities to get involved in large grants. In the hundreds of thousands and even million-pound projects are not uncommon. There are not many areas that that's true of, and also that you could be involved in multiple of those studies. There are opportunities to specialise, although it's a very big area, there are a lot of trial statisticians, there's never enough. And the other thing to know about it is if you know a bit, you know a lot more than a lot of these collaborators, as I've just demonstrated to you. And there's very early on an opportunity for you to specialise and become an expert in a subtype of a study, whether that's cluster trials, or whether it's primary care trials, or whether it's cluster primary care trials that have a bit of adaptive designs, or whatever it is. Very easy to come up with a scenario where you can specialise and have some expertise that very few other people will be that confident about. No one will do every type of trial, and so there's great opportunities there. And you do get opportunities to do methodological research alongside. It does raise up the issues as you go along. It's a well-respected area. People are interested if you can make a small difference in clinical trials, because there's so many of them going on. If you can make a small difference, that's important, so people will publish it and people will be interested in it. So if you can find a little way about doing trials that will make things slightly better, people will care. And I'd say you have an opportunity to make a difference. Trials do and have make an impact on patients' health. So my final thoughts, if your question is to be or not to be a trial statistician, I don't know what the answer is because it's very much a personal thing. I'm very much glad I have become one. I still work in there, this is how I spend my days, but you have to answer that question for yourself. But I do quite like this quote, there's never a surefire good career move except doing good work. My view is that doing trials is good work for a statistician.